When we talk about sex role conditioning, which is what psychologists call it, and I think an interesting point that was made was a study that was psychologists and psychiatrists, both male and female, of patients who come in. They came to the conclusion that they listed all the characteristics. Most of them were like the list that Sandra gave as far as children were concerned. You have the non-aggressive and the non-competitive and so forth. All of these particular attributes were given to the healthy female, and the aggressive and the competitive and the adventurous, all of these attributes were given to the healthy male. But if you were to look at the other male scale, you would find that all the attributes that were given to men were classified as the unhealthy male or the immature adult. So you see, in order for us to be mature women, we have to really be immature adults. This has to change. Because obviously the woman that strikes out on her own has to put up with not only flack from her peer group, possibly from her managers, certainly from her parents if she's just starting out and getting into an education, but she also has to put up, if she decides to go for professional help, she has to put up with a psychologist that's going to be saying, the reason you're not succeeding in this is because you're an unhealthy female, because you're aggressive. So these attitudes have to change, not only on a professional level, but on our particular levels ourselves. Now, the point is, we have to go about changing these ourselves. We can't wait for industries to do this. And when it turns out that you're the only female in an executive meeting, and they say, would you mind going and getting the Xeroxed for me, Ms. whatever, why? You know, if you're not the closest one to the door, then why don't you ask someone else to do it? The point is also that if you are the closest one to the door, don't let your paranoia get up so that you stand there and make a big deal of it. I think women defeat themselves just as quickly by overreacting. So we're kind of caught in a bind of seeking a happy medium here as far as what we determine is a realistic request and what isn't. Likewise, I think that one of the problems we have if women in industries who are considered professional women is that they are not treated, I don't want to say not treated like a man, because I don't want to say I want to be treated like a man, but not evaluated in the same way. Now, if you go into a job, this job should be clearly defined. Its objectives and what you should be doing in this job is defined. Whether you're a man or a woman, it should make no difference. And if you accomplish those goals and do what's set out, you should be rewarded the same as your male counterparts. This simply is not done. A lot of times you are expected to act a certain way. When you're expected to act that way, you will act that way. If a woman is expected to fall apart and not cope, more than likely she will fall apart and not cope, the same as a man, the same as a child. A lot of times companies do not take the chances in putting a woman into management because they are so convinced that she will fail, that she'll fail. What has to be done is they have to take chances, and there has to be this kind of idea that if I put a woman in this position, that she's going to make it. Otherwise, she's going to read it right off your face that you expect her to fail, and she will more than likely turn around and do it. Or what she will do is she'll take the I'll show them by God type of attitude. And what has she done? She turns out being a guy, you know, and so all the men accept her and they say, well, old Martha's a pretty good manager. She's just like one of the boys, you know. What have you gained? What have you gained? You've gained your managerial position, but you've lost most of the battle because you're no longer a woman. And that's what we have to maintain. We are just as good as the rest of the people if we just be ourselves. But it's learning this happy medium. I think industry has to learn to evaluate us equally, to somehow put us in positions where we can rise to the occasion. I think that that is excellent motivation for women. I think that industry needs to take more chances. And I think as far as women are concerned, that there's all the reputation that follows, that women convince themselves that they are really in good positions when they are not. And they will go on and they will find that they are stagnated as far as rising to certain positions of management. They'll quit and they'll go to another company. So what happens is industry looks at your resume and says, "You have a job hopper." Statistics show that a number of the statistics that people take in saying, "Well, women just don't stay on jobs that long," if they really looked into them, they found that the reason they don't stay is because they can't go anywhere once they're in a job. So there should be growth plans that are set up in companies so that women can follow through. They don't have to spend a year at this job and a year at this job and so forth and do this job hopping. For those women that are married, some companies now are setting up daycare centers. Why should a woman, if she wants to pursue a career and she also wants to have a family, why shouldn't she have these facilities provided? There's also some companies that are looking into flexible hours, because obviously if a woman wants to combine both, then she needs to have hours that she can work and still take care of the family matters at hand. So I think these are great steps that the companies are looking into. But the problem of female development, I believe, is a problem for all of us. Because we're not really talking about female, we're talking about people. And I think as soon as we can convince everyone that the sex war is really passé, we're people, and that's what we're concerned about, people being motivated and people getting a job done. And when you say, "This is the job, I think you can get out there and do it," I think that's when you're going to see women get out there and do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn. Our next speaker is Mr. Alfred Gardner from Lockheed.
Some time ago, I was invited to present a paper on the general subject of women moving into engineering management positions. And as part of my preparation for that paper, I distributed a rather lengthy questionnaire to quite a number of my associates. And by coincidence, a couple of them happen to be in the room right now, comprising women, technical, non-technical, administrative, men, both in technical and non-technical positions, some of our vice presidents, chief engineers, etc. I'd like to tell you something of the cross-section of answers to a number of those questions which apply to the subject at hand. About a third of them were designed to determine what prejudices exist in the executive engineering ranks and to try to describe them if possible. Interesting that most of the men acknowledged the discriminatory practices as a difficult barrier for the aspiring women. It's also interesting that most, though not all, denied strong personal prejudice, but saw it in the world around them and blamed it on customs of society, and all of the women claimed discrimination exists based on their own observation and experience. And I think we could expect that. One of the questions was, what criteria, characteristics, or other factors have influenced your nomination and selection of people to move into management positions? I'm sure you recognize how difficult a task is represented by this question. We've all seen excellent people at one level promoted to mediocrity at another level. That's due to the subtle differences in the key requirements for successively responsible jobs. Numerous elements of consideration were suggested, and I regard them sort of as variables of a partial differential equation of various orders and unknowns. However, I think there are definitions on which we can agree, and I'll discuss some of the suggestions. The overwhelming opinion was technical competence. That includes a good basic education and continuing upgrading as technology evolves. I've heard it said in our company, for instance, that the half-life of an engineer is approximately 10 years. Allied to technical competence is knowledge of the job, and under which must be grouped the objectives of the enterprise, your customers, how you use your resources, functional management relationships, and the basic organization. Another factor receiving near unanimous endorsement was demonstrated supervisory capacity and leadership. These covered skills like effective communication techniques, knowing how to delegate, decision-making ability and judgment, motivating and understanding people, including the customer and your own organization, and problem-solving ability, whatever you might describe that as. Many personal items were mentioned, including the physical and mental stamina, the stability of the individual, the demonstrated loyalty both to the component organization and the overall organization, self-help and improvement as evidence of desire to progress, ability to command respect and a credibility as an individual, professional, management, and other skills, and whether the promotion in question is a logical next step in the individual's career. I'd like to give you a quote from one of our senior technical people. He said, "First of all, they must be visible. I perceive they have skills of broader, non-parochial vision. They have desire. They tend to be good communicators. They tend to convey trustworthiness and strength of convictions. They tend to have good judgment, and I perceive them to be gifted with leadership, parenthesis, whatever that is." And that's his quote. "I trust their moral judgment and tend to like their moral philosophy." This man is someone I respect and admire, and regardless of what you may think of his answers, if women are going to progress into responsible positions, this man is typical of the type of individual you must impress to get the promotion. The next question was, what are the toughest problems facing a woman engineer who aspires to a management position? The primary answer was overwhelming: the conditioned bias and antiquated views of males. I think that women engineers and other technical women would tend to see this problem reflected in virtually all male technicians or technical people. I'll trip over the word engineers here because I was dealing with so many engineers at the particular time. Whereas many of the males recognized it much more clearly in other males than in themselves, almost all agree that it will be overcome by increasing the number of women in technical jobs and by acceptance through performance by those women who do succeed, and especially as managers. A related and commonly stated answer was the problem of convincing top management that women deserve opportunity, consideration, and acceptance because they are qualified. I think that this problem will automatically disappear if you eliminate the conditioned bias we have been talking about as our younger male managers move into top executive positions. Additionally, women must establish the credibility of their intentions by convincing management that they are breadwinner-type employees, and destroy the myth that women are temporary employees, regardless of length of employment. And I'll belabor the obvious by adding, we need to get rid of the idea that women are not technical, not managerial, not mechanical, etc. Let me tell you about two interesting answers. The first probably applies to any pioneer and unique achiever. Recognizing that women in technology will be in the minority for many years to come, one person contended, and it was a woman, that the woman manager's biggest problem will be maintaining a balanced perspective about herself. I'm not certain of the magnitude of such a problem, but it could be real, and in large measure it can be avoided by preparation for successive promotions. The second unique comment also came from a woman. She stated that you might run into husband-boyfriend ego problems if your advancement and achievement exceed his. I agree with that possibility, but I'm not sure I want to admit it. The next question was, what advice would you give a young woman engineer early in her career who seeks your advice on how to work into a management position? The most common and basic recommendation was, prove your technical competence and stay current in the technology of your field and be willing to work hard. This would include making yourself visible through achievement and willingness to take on tough and unpleasant tasks. I heard those same words put differently just a few minutes ago. A natural consequence should then be the convincing of your peers and superiors that you can and will perform. A number of comments referred to being able to take it in the course of the natural rough and tumble of groups that arrive at technical solutions to concepts, designs, test programs, specs, you name it. One individual summarized it well by urging that you must be sure you want a career and be willing to follow it with devotion and ability to overcome discouragement. Continued education and related skills was often mentioned. This would include training and skills associated with leadership, communication, business, finance, marketing, labor practices. Also related would be learning to make decisions and recognizing that some will be wrong, as well as developing the emotional maturity and stability to take on responsibilities that affect the lives of your associates. Some felt that careful choices of field, company, and even boss are necessary, and that the career plan should be known to one supervisor. I've seen this kind of situation work in reverse, as I'm sure many of you have, where the young, ambitious worker is regarded as a threat. Women probably occupy a special status under our current ideas in society in this regard. Therefore, your advertised goals and aspirations need careful and deliberate planning. They must be tempered with a good personal image, tact, and understanding of the circumstances in which you work. Good planning objectives and consideration of flexible alternatives to your goals is also highly recommended. Various peripheral recommendations were made, such as avoiding special favors based on sex, participation in professional societies, help your boss get promoted, that's a good rule anyplace, care and personal appearance and actions. In general, the recommendations can be summarized into knowing what you want to do and why you want to do it, preparing adequately, planning carefully, and working hard and evaluating your progress in terms of yourself and the environment in which you're working. These are sort of platitudes, because each is a very difficult task in itself. However, they are the general framework on which my colleagues' specific recommendations have to be hung. I'd also add that the women in the technical field, like in many others, must excel and stand out across the board to a marked degree greater than a male counterpart if she's going to beat him to the finish line, and then she may still need a few lucky breaks currently. The last question was, what changes must occur to ensure impartiality of treatment of women in technical management? The similarity of the previous question was intentional, because I believe the difference is critical to the subject at hand. The earlier question was aimed at identifying the problems. I wanted to focus attention on possible ways to solve the problems. The problems identified earlier are seen reasonably well by both men and women engineers. However, I have a feeling that the changes that must occur probably are known more definitely and consciously by women. And I think we saw evidence of that this morning. They're one of the key indicators as to how we proceed. And I know I'm by no means anywhere near the first to understand that. Once again, the unanimous primary answer was the necessity for attitude changes. This starts with making the male community recognize their attitude and what it costs them, getting them to understand what is called the non-conscious ideology. It should be followed by affirmative action that is positive and flexible. A war of the sexes might eliminate one problem and substitute a worse one, or cause resistance based on resentment and fear, and that would discourage progress. A second answer was to increase the supply of eligible and qualified women. The effect of such an increase is obvious. The obstacles are many, and they don't all lie with the attitude and habits of the male community. We must promote the idea that the technical woman is not a point off the curve to be regarded with curiosity and dismissed as sort of a transient data point, but she's a common everyday member of the normal technical labor market, and companies like mine live on that market. Finally, many responses recommended company management action. These included willingness to experiment with changes of labor and management practices, and where possible, to solve the problems with what a changing mix of technical personnel will bring. They also included the necessity to establish meaningful affirmative action programs, to provide communications and action which would educate all concerned to the needs, the possibilities, and the realities of the circumstances of the situation. Well, in the time and talent framework that I have available, this is how it is in our large and reasonably representative company.
Anyone in the audience have a question they'd like to ask?
Almost each speaker, I think each one of you, said that the orientation of the boy and girl when they're young is where all this started. Well, I happen to have been raised to have been told that I was as intelligent as anybody of my counterpart. And for 22 years, I worked in a technical field, various technical fields, and believed this. And I noticed you saying you yourself to be a technical librarian. I finally got tired of fighting the world and settled for being just that, a technical librarian. And 22 years of engineering experience to allow me to do this. I think many of us, and I'm sure that I must be one of the pioneers of, because I have often been the one woman in several hundred men in my field. And through the years, I've had the audacity on occasion to believe I was, or I was being accepted as to it as my counterpart in the male world. But once I began to think this, I was soon knocked down and let know that I was not. And this is the reason I'm a technical librarian, making that sick. I got a hole and I do not want to be sick anymore. Well, I'm becoming more sick. And with a new movement for which I am glad of, I think people like me that have dared to trespass will now be able to get into the world. It'll be better for the upcoming generations than
you may want to change your mind again, too.
I think I may.
May I make a comment as a compliance manager? You're talking right, you know, down the line that I've worked, and revised order 4 is on the books because there is discrimination. There has been discrimination. And there are now laws that you as an individual can resort to correct some of the problems. I'm not trying to be a traitor to my class, but I certainly would investigate the statistics of the management team in your business. And if you are seriously a candidate for that, I'd discuss with them the statistics that you know about and your potential referral to FEPC or EEOC or whatever. You have that right.
I think that many of us over the years have run into the same problem, but we've met them maybe in different ways. I sort of met them by, whenever I went into an organization, sort of forming my own company within the company, so to speak. And this was one way of getting around some of the manager problems, also by becoming very widely known throughout the company, which means that your manager can't quite behave in the ways he might have behaved otherwise. But each of us does have the same sort of problem and as I said, have had to find our own ways of meeting it and have found our own roadblocks all along the line.
It was not top management that I had my problems with. It was the immediate supervisor who interviewed me as a courtesy. You already hired. But then after the interview, we take this place, say, what phenomenon of woman goes into this type of work? You know, who wants to work for someone directly that has this attitude about what a top manager thinks they're
good or not? Well, I think that's one of the reasons I formed my own company, in effect, so that the person directly above me would sort of have to leave the group alone. It's
of course
a defensive motion.
You weren't competing at that time with top management either.
That's true. Yes.
I think one of the serious things that women should consider at this point where they're arrived at the top is to jump companies, because oftentimes you do have a built-in prejudice in your own company. But with your experience, you can go to another company, higher step than you can make in your own.
I always felt that I was rather lucky in a way, because I had rather spectacular opportunities to prove my expertise. And sometimes a sense of drama goes a long way.
You know, may I ask a question? I was listening to Mr. Gardner from Lockheed and the list of qualifications. Most impressive. I was wondering if the men that are promoted to management have those same qualifications.
I'm not sure whether I'm being baited or not, but as I pointed out, the answers represented a composite of all of the answers that I got back. Now, as to whether this is true in real life, I, on the basis of my ability to judge the managers I see about me, I'd say that in a large percentage of the time, yes, and I think because we have such a wealth of material to draw on. And for instance, in tune with Executive Order 4, we have found it necessary on selection panels to emphasize something that is almost un-American and un-apple pie. That qualification for the position is all that's required. That if somebody is 4 times qualified and somebody else is 3 times qualified, we don't eliminate the person who is qualified. But it's a very difficult process. We've all been trained to strive and be first and get the most and be the biggest. And I'm sure that must be a problem in your company. And it is part of the backlash where the man says, well, my qualifications are superior to his. Why did you choose him? And oftentimes, the superior qualifications are not needed on the job at all.
Well, I really have a little different view, because I still think we're in a position to promote the most qualified individual. And I think if we honestly do that, we're going to promote many, many women, and in proportion to their existence in the source pool. I listen to the backlash all around me. You know, you get it every place you go. And I think it's a bunch of nonsense. Women are just as capable and can be measured by the same yardsticks in terms of their actual achievement when given the opportunity. So I don't apologize to any white male who claims that he's being discriminated against on the basis of anything that's happened yet in industry. I have a hard time honestly believing that management males are promoted by the criteria that we're suggesting for Superwoman, simply because there are a number of failures around. What I'm advocating, I suppose, is an opportunity for women to have an opportunity to fail, if they will.
Yeah, something that I noticed was true, and I don't think we touched on it, but I felt like it isn't so much true anymore because of Executive Order 4. It gives a man a reason to promote a woman today or give her some unusual opportunity. But I seem to recall that when something, good fortune, would befall a woman, that quite often then the other fellas would start accusing, maybe just in the form of teasing, the man who did it as though he had some really personal relationship with this woman. And that would happen time after time in many situations I know of, so that he almost would not give a woman an opportunity because he wouldn't want to take the razzing the guys would give him.
Well, that's one of the practical aspects of how you fight this whole situation. I think all of us have had to come up with some answers to many of the cliche questions that get thrown at us. And sometimes it's a good idea just to sit down and think, well, everybody keeps asking you things, you get bored with them after a while. You have to have a ready, quick response. And some of them feel that you're being a traitor, shall we say, if you become ambitious. I pointed out to some people I know the other day that if I didn't love men, I wouldn't be in this business at all. We're not here because we dislike men, and we're not asking for promotion or advancement because we dislike men. That's not the case. As a matter of fact, we work well with men. That's why we're here. And we enjoy it, and we enjoy playing an action game, and we're active in doing the same thing that the men are trying to do a very good job, the best job that we can.
I'd like to address this to Mr. Hitchcock. To what extent has lack of mobility been used as a justification for not promoting women beyond like second level management positions?
Well, you mean real lack of mobility or imagined lack of mobility?
Whatever.
What happens, of course, is that men who are making decisions to promote get together in the smoke-filled room and say, oh, gee, who shall we consider? And then a woman's name comes up and they say to themselves, oh, well, she wouldn't really want to move, and maybe the job after next will require that she does. Of course, they don't go and ask her. It's often used as an excuse, but it's not a valid excuse under any circumstances.
How do you convince the men in that room that that's not right?
Well, that's where the affirmative action program comes in. And I've become much more sympathetic with the policeman after getting into this job. But the best measurement of success is a tangible item called numbers of promotions and numbers of career development assignments. And any company, any large company particularly, who doesn't keep a very close track of what's happening in each manager's bailiwick is missing a tremendous opportunity to have an effect on the long-term position of that company under the law. And you know, in a sense, women are a tremendous threat to industry because there are a lot of them there. There are a lot of them who have potential back wage claims. And the amount of money that could be involved in exercising women's rights as they exist today under the law, it would be unbelievable, I think, to many of us.
Mr. Hitchcock, I know of an interesting story along this line that happens to come right out of your own telephone company. Recently, there was an opportunity to come up for, which involved promotional possibilities, but it would involve moving to another location. Each man in the office was asked if he would consider moving, and some of them said yes, and some of them said no. Nothing had been said till all the men in the office had been canvassed to the woman who was an engineer. Finally, her boss decided he better do it because this was required of him. So he asked her if she would move, and she said, why, yes. And he says, but don't you have to ask your husband first? She said, well, you didn't ask the men if they had to ask their wives first. Why do you ask me this? And he said, well, that's different. He said, no, it's not. It's the same situation. And this is true.
Well, as I said earlier, we haven't changed that guy's way of thinking, but we did change his way of acting. At least he asked.
Right. Yes.
I'm Dudley, and I'm looking for a job, and I noticed that they spend a lot of time asking questions about my husband. You know, what he does, what's, you know, what his ambitions and things like that. The men, are they inquired about their wives?
It's not. I should really let you answer this because you're a compliance officer, but you cannot ask women any different questions than you would ask a man, and if they ask you that, they're not acting according to the law.
Have you really found this to be a rather widespread situation? Because I would be quite surprised. I've been involved in interviewing, and as Cynthia indicated, there's as far as I know within my company, certainly no differences in anything that goes on in an interview.
I've been interviewing with small companies again.
Well, that's very interesting. I think you should continue your interviewing because you will find many companies that not only will not do that, but will be very interested in your capabilities, precisely yours.
Come see us.
Have you mostly interviewed with personnel recruiters, or have you talked actually to the engineer for whom you would be working?
No, I've never gotten
injured. The reason I'm saying this is because being one of the people who came along much earlier in the game, I never got jobs through the personnel department. I learned early that the woman engineer never goes to the personnel department. They go to the engineer for whom they would be working. They then are hired, and then the personnel department is notified that they have been hired. This is... Well, it may not no longer be true, but I'm talking about the past. I realize this, I'm talking about the dark ages.
Can I ask you a question? Did you talk to recruiters at the university?
No, I'm from Tennessee, and I came up here to live in California.
I see. All right. Were you ever recruited at your bachelor's level, I take it, or master's level? At the bachelor's level.
And I would say this is very, very close. And the fact that I was a widow, I think, helped me greatly to get through the IR man. And the fact that I was later married made it much easier for me to make the men I was working with talk more about me. I think that this is a very insidious thing when it comes to trying to get through the IR man. It's very difficult for a young person out of school to know the engineer they would be working for.
That's right.
And how else do you get into a company that through IR?
Well, the reason there's sort of a special reason for my asking this, because increasingly at the universities where I've been working, we find that the recruiting effort is directed toward the women technical graduates, and that they are being told and being directed toward a series of jobs. No longer are you coming in as a double E with a bachelor's and the responsibility here, but what I have noticed a trend that where would you like to be 3 years from now or 4 years from now, and how can we get you there? This is being done at the campus level in the recruiting office. And I think this augurs well for the kind of the kind of direction that we've taken here, that we're talking about career planning in the longer term, not career planning until you get married.
Certainly things are better now, but I know a number of times my husband and I, we both have PhDs in nuclear physics, and when we look for a job, most always we'd look for two jobs, not one. We had to go as a pair. And sometimes working very different areas of the block, we work sometimes very close and sometimes rather removed. It naturally is contingent, and I feel, based on certainly as recent as a couple of years ago, it would be very difficult, say, for a young couple married, for the wife to get a job. You know, and that would be why they're interested in the husband and what he's doing, because I think they still haven't, you know, got over that hurdle yet. And there probably are some practical reasons in terms of the two, and they figure, well, you know, who's going to stay home, or the most likely to stay home? They're still probably going to bet on the woman. Things have significantly improved, because like at my first job, in terms of offers, I think my husband probably got 10 times the number that I did. I mean, there were lots of offers, but it just shows you what the ratio was. Today it's no longer like that, of course, but you do run this problem, and you probably will have, if you want to get a permanent job, will have difficulty until you know exactly when he's going to be through and what the two of you are going to do. You know, you'd have to give them that information and be fairly convincing.
I'd like to add, however, that I know of no practices in Lockheed today that would differentiate between the fact that your husband is a graduate or not a graduate. I don't think we'd go into that at all. I'm in fact thinking of our employment form. I don't know where it says anything except married or not married, and I'm not sure of that anymore. So if I understand your question correctly, we would not take into account the fact that your husband is in college if you're qualified for some opening which we'd like to fill with you.
Well,
in fact, if any employer raises that issue, it's against the law. It's sex discrimination, potentially.
It may be illegal. On the other hand, I do hiring myself. And when I'm hiring people, I take into account how long I think they'll stay with me, how long they'll be interested in the job. So
and that's perfectly appropriate.
But if
you take into account that they're married and therefore their husband might or wife might lead them away, then it's not. I'm sure that our employment forms are set up the same way, and they've been gone over by fancy attorneys, and the questions that would get at the issue that you raise to allow an employment interviewer to make those judgments are simply off the form.
Yeah, I think formally that's certainly true, but if you were going to hire someone and train them to do a particular job that it takes several years to do, I think practically it comes down to.
Because one thing that is involved here that you should point out maybe to some of these people is that hiring a man doesn't guarantee that he's going to stay on the job for more than 2 or 3 years either, because he may get a better offer someplace else and hop jobs than they often do, particularly if they're very ambitious. So the fact that a woman will be changing jobs in 2 or 3 years is no different from that of a man. In fact, I think the statistics will support the fact that women tend to stay longer on the jobs than men.
Case in point on encouraging some ladies in the scientific work for this young engineers competition that we have had over the past several years, and unfortunately don't have now. I'm not sure how the lower competition, at least in the ones we saw in earlier the Westcon shows, you recall over half of the participants were girls, and they did very well in the presentations they made. Now, I'm not saying that's the only way to encourage them, but it shows that many of them had really good talent, and it showed, and they got the prize awards on those exhibits, and I'm sure there were 100 more that we never saw because they were eliminated earlier. But I think there's one of the facets of detecting early interest and capability.
Well, when Lockheed was conducting this program for high school students, high school women students, one of the things that we found was that one of our problems was some of the high school counselors. Some high school counselors wouldn't even pass out the notice, wouldn't even inform the young women that the opportunity to come to this program existed. We did would announce it in the company paper, and many of the fathers would come home and find out about it and insist that their daughters get a chance to come. Or sometimes we'd have notice in the paper and people would find out there. But one of our problems was high school counselors who, even when you have a young woman who is skilled in this area, will not encourage her to continue. Yes?
Can you tell us what sort of thoughts were going through your mind when, during your undergraduate days? Did you know, have any idea whatsoever what on earth you were going to be able to do when you got your degree?
Well, I sort of gave myself an aptitude test when I went through the college catalog and picked the field that had all the interesting subjects so far as I was concerned. And so perhaps my thoughts were somewhat vague, but being a Westerner, I have more had maybe more direct contact with a lot of engineering operations than some of the other people in some of the other areas might. For instance, they were building some of the dams here, in the, you know, the big dams in the West, and this sort of thing was going on. And we did have an opportunity to visit those areas. We did have an opportunity to go up to Kellogg and visit the smelters, go through the, some of the mines. I didn't, I suppose, know specifically what I would do. I knew that some people, some women who had gone into this field had done such things as work for some of the technical magazines. And since I had a strong writing background, I thought this might be a possibility. The dean of our college used to say, well, the job that most metallurgists get when they get out of school is to be an assayer. So your first year, be the best assayer they ever had, and then start being rotten. So you have a chance to be something else. And this is pretty good sound basic advice, no matter how you start out, because I think many, many people can get trapped in their careers, and I've kept this little thought in mind as I went along. Maybe that's one of the things that helped me.
Oh, very, very definitely. You just can't say, well, this is going to be restricted, so you know, this is the best avenue, so take that. I think the only way you can do it is if you have the aptitude and you think you want to go into it, you go into it. There are the hardships you're going to have to endure. That's just part of life. But you've got to take that step. Just have to.
I've always advised all engineers, male or female, that in order to be an engineer in the first place, you had to be stubborn. And also, you have to have a high sense of integrity, because if you don't have that, you might as well not be an engineer. That's what they're paying you for, your expertise in the field plus your integrity, but those two go hand in hand. I think we're coming to the end of our time. I'll try to run briefly through. On the end here, we have Sandra Hawley, who is Manager of Information Services at ESL, Jim Hitchcock, who is Compliance Manager for the Telephone Company, Cynthia Pruitt, who is Quality Assurance Manager for IBM, Dr. Tony Mallow, who is in the Graduate School of Business at Santa Clara University, where he works in the area of teaching courses and planning courses in management training. Carolyn Morris from Hewlett-Packard, who's in marketing. Mr. Alfred Gardner, who's from Lockheed, and assistant to the president of Lockheed. And Dr. Lillian Singletary with TRW, where she is a project manager.
IEEE Soundings is a registered service mark of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, New York.